This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. What would happen if the United States collapsed as a world power? There are several countries working to undermine America's power and reshape the world order. We have a couple of stories on today's show about this, one showing efforts to undermine and isolate America economically, and the other militarily. We'll hear a report from trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques about the increasing success China is having in its efforts to become the premier trading powerhouse in the world. It is drawing several nations into a trade bloc aimed at reducing the world's dependence on America and preparing for a world economy that doesn't need America. Then we'll hear from Andrew Miller about a report published by a former U.S. defense official saying that the world is undergoing a military revolution that threatens to unseat America as the world superpower. Foreign nations are actively working to create technologies, spending only millions of dollars, that neutralize American defense systems that cost billions of dollars. I hope you stick around for those reports later in the program. And also today's last word, where I'll talk about a form of love that might not look like love. We'll begin, though, by talking about the price of gasoline. Brace yourself. It could be going up significantly in the coming months because of some important world events, as we will learn in this report from Richard Palmer.
For a lot of the stories that we cover, it's not obvious how they affect you. This one is different. A series of world events could very soon lead to you paying much more to fill up your car. Of course, the implications of this news event spread much further than that. The world runs on oil, and high oil prices could have dramatic implications for a whole host of news events. Starting on Thursday, Iran will be banned from selling any oil anywhere in the world. Anyone who flouts this ban risks being cut off from the U.S. economy.
We will continue to enforce sanctions and monitor compliance. Any nation or entity interacting with Iran should do its diligence and err on the side of caution. The risks are simply not going to be worth the benefits.
Now, since its latest sanctions went into effect back in November, the U.S. agreed to tolerate certain nations buying oil from Iran. For example, in March, China, India, Japan, and South Korea combined imported about 1.57 million barrels a day from Iran. That tolerance will end, and experts expect Iran's total oil exports to drop to about 600,000 barrels a day. So that's going to put some pressure on Iran. But it's also going to reduce the global oil supply by somewhere around 1 million barrels per day. At the same time, the U.S. is squeezing Venezuela. U.S. sanctions came into force on Sunday, targeting their state-run oil company. Even before the sanctions hit, America's oil trade with Venezuela had collapsed. In 2008, Venezuela was producing about 3 million barrels of oil per day. And in March, that had slumped to 840,000. And again, that's before the latest sanctions hit. So, just like with Iran, while great for standing up for the people of Venezuela, not great for global oil supplies. Then there's the violence in North Africa. If the civil war worsens in Libya, their 1 million barrels of oil per day may not make it to market. Unrest in Algeria would interrupt a similar amount of trade. So you've got a decent chunk of the global oil supply under threat right now. Now, Saudi Arabia's promised to make up the shortfall, but they're not going to be quick to actually carry out that promise. They did respond quickly in November when the initial Iranian sanctions hit. However, the US granted more waivers than the Saudis were expecting, and so instead of saving the world from expensive oil, the Saudi Arabia ended up selling their dwindling oil supply at bargain basement prices. They're not keen to make that mistake again. And then there are also questions about whether they can even pump more oil, with some recent evidence that their oil fields are lower than we've believed before. The Telegraph's Ambrose Evans Pritchard wrote that global spare capacity is arguably as low today as it was during the great oil shocks of the last half century. We are skating on thin ice. He cites Westbrook Capital Jean-Louis Lemie warning that oil spare capacity will fall to 1.2 million barrels per day by the autumn. And he writes, this will not be enough to cover demand, even if nothing goes wrong. And a great deal is likely to go wrong. We're seeing oil prices rise already. Brent crude hit a six-month high last week above $75 a barrel. Prices have increased by about 40% since January. Bank of America wrote that we see a risk of $100 Brent by the end of the year. And you know, this is a threat that not too many are aware of. And so Pritchard warns that with few prepared for this, the theatrics could be spectacular. Now, I think it's far from a foregone conclusion that we are facing a catastrophic rise in oil prices, though definitely at least a general price rise seems very likely. But it's a reminder of just how, whether or not we have some kind of oil catastrophe hit this summer, you know, it's a reminder of how dependent the global economy and therefore everyone's welfare is on just one single commodity. I mean, most of us drive, most commute to work. In the US, the average commute is 26.1 minutes each way. And that's nearly an hour of driving. And if fuel prices go up, well, you know, you can't cut back on your commute time without losing your job. And so for most of us, higher fuel prices contribute directly to reduced disposable income, reduced spending, and then that affects the global economy. But even if you cycle to work, you'll still be affected. And the cost of just moving stuff around is a major component of the cost of all kinds of goods. For example, food. The agricultural industry is more dependent on oil than any other sector of the economy except transportation. Farm machinery runs on oil. Many agricultural chemicals are made using oil or natural gas, which is generally affected as well by oil prices. And transportation just makes up, again, a major part of the overall cost of food. Now, a short-term jump in oil doesn't always feed through to other commodities. But as the International Food Policy Research Institute wrote, international fuel and food prices are closely linked historically. Rising oil prices were closely associated with the 1972 to 74 crisis and indeed were arguably the dominant factor. And they argued that high oil prices probably played a major role in the latest food crisis in 2008, which shook governments in third world countries across the world. This is why fluctuations in oil prices draw so much attention. Now, there's been an important change in this dynamic in recent years. The US has been fracking and is now the world's number one oil producer. The number one producer of crude oil. Even so, the US still consumes about 2 million barrels of oil per day more than it produces. But the shift does mean that now some Americans benefit from higher oil prices. And there are, it is in some ways a good thing. Fracking is expensive. Oil companies have had to borrow very heavily to make it happen. Higher prices could keep these companies in business and even expand, helping to keep Americans in jobs. But the fact remains that you know, the oil prices, overall high oil prices, especially very high oil prices, have a negative effect on the US economy and the global economy. And oil is a high-risk commodity. It's a commodity that's very easy to reach out and attack. A lot of oil travels through very narrow ocean passageways. Roughly two-thirds of the world's oil travels over the oceans to reach its final destination. One-third of that seaborne oil travels through the Straits of Hormuz, a 21-mile-wide sea gate controlled by Iran. After President Trump announced that all nations had to comply with the U.S. oil embargo on Iran, the commander of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps Navy threatened to close that strait. And Iran doesn't have to permanently close that strait to cause a lot of damage. Just shutting it down for days or weeks could cause major delays and set oil prices soaring. And Hormuz isn't the only choke point. The South China Sea, where China is quickly gaining control, well, that also hosts one-third of the world's ocean-going oil. About 10% passes through the Suez and the nearby Sumed pipeline. About 5% through the Bab el-Mandeb Strait, or more than 5%. Now that America produces its own oil, it's under much less risk of being starved of this vital commodity. But high oil prices from the closure of any of these passages would still take a chunk out of the global economy. And the Bible indicates that this vulnerability could play a major role in world events very soon. Like we said, Iran already has the ability probably to close the Straits of Hormuz. Daniel chapter 11 and verse 40 to 45 warn us that Iran, the king of the south in this prophecy, will also get control of Egypt and Libya and Ethiopia. That would give them control of so many of the world's oil choke points. Control of Egypt would mean control of the Suez Canal. Control of Ethiopia would probably include the whole Horn of Africa and the Bab el-Mandeb Strait. Libya is an oil-producing nation in its own right. And it would provide Iran with a strategic base on the Mediterranean. And Iran already virtually controls Iraq, the world's fourth largest oil producer. Daniel chapter 11 describes that this king of the south pushing against a German-led king of the north. And America is not mentioned. In that booklet, Mr. Flory wrote, Arab-Iranian control over the Mediterranean Sea and the Red Sea could be the real reason the US is not involved in this Mideast war in Daniel 11. Our economy is shaky, the dollar is extremely weak, and Iran could threaten or even cut off all our oil and wreck the US economy to keep America out of the war. And they can still threaten those global oil supplies. As far back as 1994, Mr. Flory speculated that an attack on global oil supplies by Iran could have huge ramifications. He wrote that it could help trigger a collapse of the Western world's weak currencies. This in turn could cause Europe to quickly unite into the most powerful economic bloc in the world. That very event is prophesied to occur in your Bible. So it could have huge ramifications for Europe. So we could have some oil problems in the near future with this upcoming shortage potentially in global oil supplies. But with the rise of Iran, there's a long-term risk of a catastrophic oil shortage that even if we don't see it this summer, isn't going away. That could have a major effect on world events. And our free book, The King of the South, will help show how this ties right in with Bible prophecy and how that could unfold.
Thank you very much for that, Richard. Well, you know, a lot of the factors that are putting this pressure on global oil prices trace back to the United States aiming to curb bad behavior, to make the world safer from dangerous states like Iran and Venezuela. And it's interesting, though, how much other nations are being affected, other nations that have become dependent on oil production from these countries. We're going to talk later in the program with Jeremiah about efforts by China and other countries to build economic and trade infrastructure apart from the United States. And in some ways, you can see how that's a reaction against these types of moves by America. As America is trying to create more global stability, they're actually intensifying some of the anti-Americanism among America's enemies.
Yeah, I like one of the comparisons Ambrose Evans Pritchard made in one of his articles where he said the best historical parallel for what the US is doing is what the Royal Navy did in the early 1800s to stamp out the slave trade, where they just said, well, we're going to board ships, even if they belong to other countries, even if they're countries we're not at war with, neutral ship, we're going to board them, we're going to inspect them, we're going to make sure nobody's doing any slave trading. It caused an uproar, but Britain said it's right, we're doing it anyway. Mm-hmm. And you see something kind of similar in that the United States is engaging in something that, you know, they're dealing with this dictator that's killing his own people in Venezuela, they're dealing with this menace in Iran, but you know, rightly or wrongly, they're doing it in a way that treads on other nations' toes, that tells them if your business, if your bank that we otherwise have no control over, but if they do business with Iran, we're going to shut them out of the global financial system. And it's causing a lot of resentment. It's causing Europe to get together and say, well, how can we create our own financial system? How can we be less dependent on the US? It's Russia and China have already embarked down the
down the same process. So I think, confronting these countries is absolutely the right thing to do. But at the same time, you're seeing a growing backlash. In a lot of ways, it just exposes, I think, the dissatisfaction nations have already with the United States. You know, right. The way that they're, you know, when you come down to it, where Europe is being given the choice, do you support the United States or do you support Iran? And they're saying, you know what, we're going to try and find a way to keep doing business with Iran. That's a pretty surprising level of animosity against the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So it's exposing some of what's already there and creating an incentive for these countries to say we want to find our own ways of doing trade.
Yeah, you mentioned toward the end there about just how this highlights the vulnerability of the global economy. When you look at energy flow, oil flow around the world, and these factors that are influencing energy production, maybe you could just talk a little bit more about that vulnerability and the global infrastructure of security, how vulnerable it is to disruption because of this.
There are quite a few people that look at things like Iran threatening the Straits of Hormuz, and they almost dismiss it because they just kind of say, well, America's got a $600 billion a year military. You know, Iran's what? I don't know, maybe a tenth of that. There's no way they can take on Iran and win. But what that doesn't understand is that, you know, breaking things is easier than building things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a master craftsman can create a work of sculpture. A 2-year-old can destroy it in 30 seconds. When it comes to a lot of these passageways, you know, I mentioned that the Straits of Hormuz is only 21 miles wide. The sea lanes where the ships go through in each direction are just 2 miles wide. And so to shut that down, that doesn't take much. You just need to put in a few mines. You need to retain a few fast patrol boats hidden on shore. You just need to make it so that oil companies don't want to risk the massive investment that is a ship full of oil. They don't want that the men on the ship say, well, yeah, I might make it through, but I might not. I don't want to risk my life to try and bring this oil through. You just need to have that risk, and you have to have that in place for even just a matter of days. And you have cause a massive oil crisis. And the Strait of Hormuz is just one of the most important straits, but it's just one strait, and there are many. And so actually the job of the United States, if they're trying to keep these sea lanes open, is very hard. You've got to be able to sweep the mines. You've got to be able to go on shore and make sure there aren't any fast patrol boats hidden anywhere. And sure, in the end, the United States could win that battle. But the question is, how much damage could Iran do in the meantime? And that's why their threat to close the Straits of Hormuz remains a potent one. And that's, you know, an illustration of just how vulnerable a lot of the global economy can be to this.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've been talking with trumpet writer Richard Palmer about the possibility of oil prices rising significantly in the months ahead. He wrote about this in his Trumpet Brief yesterday. If you don't subscribe to this free email service, I'd encourage you to do so. You can just go to thetrumpet.com and sign up for it. Thank you very much, Richard.
Great to be here.
The voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
China is undertaking a massive project to become the premier trading powerhouse in the world, and it's having significant success. This is because China and a growing number of its trading partners are eager to reshape a global economy that is so dependent on the United States, as we will now hear in this report from Jeremiah Jacques.
When Italy formally signed on to China's Belt and Road Initiative last month, It represented a landmark victory for China. But it also gave the world an alarming indication of Europe's anti-American future. And it showed how some major Bible prophecies about China, Europe, and the United States are rushing toward fulfillment. The Belt and Road Initiative, or the BRI, is the brainchild of Chinese President Xi Jinping. It's his plan to rebuild the ancient network of trade routes that used to facilitate the flow of goods and ideas across Asia, the Middle East, Africa, and Europe. Since 2013, Xi has been working to convince nations in those regions to cooperate with China, to build all kinds of roads, rail networks, bridges, and ports, to rebuild that ancient Silk Road. And it's all for the purpose of better connecting the world to China. If the BRI comes together as planned, its infrastructure will connect more than 60% of the global population and about 36% of total global GDP to China. Many countries jumped on the opportunity to join the BRI without hesitation. Especially in poorer parts of Asia, Africa, and the Middle East, the idea of having China come in and build road, rail, and ports so that these poor nations could be better developed sounded almost too good to be true. So numerous countries in these regions wasted no time signing up, and they accepted massive loans from China so that they can become important stops along the BRI. But in Europe, many of the nations were reluctant. These countries were long worried about China's human rights abuses, its deceitful trade practices, and its tendency to poach foreign investors' intellectual property. They were also worried about China's debt trap diplomacy and its predatory takeovers, which often end up giving China considerable power over borrowing countries. And on top of all of that, the EU's biggest trade partner is the United States, which it has been for years, and the US is unequivocally anti-BRI. And American leaders often caution nations in Europe and elsewhere not to join it. So all of these factors combined to initially make EU countries view the BRI with quite a lot of skepticism, and to think for the most part that they should not work toward getting more deeply integrated into the Chinese economy. But over the last few years, a few of the less powerful EU nations, including Greece, ended up signing on to the BRI. And that may have played a role in convincing Italy to make the decision to formally join last month. But in either case, Italy's decision was notable because Italy is a G7 nation. The G7 is a grouping of democratically governed, advanced economies, and they're powerful. The other ones in the group are the United States, the UK, Canada, Japan, Germany, and France. And these countries all play a significant role in shaping global policy. So the fact that one of these G7 countries has now signed on to China's BRI is a big victory for China, and it could persuade more European nations to jump on board this Chinese project. And that's one big reason why the U.S. has been so vocal in its displeasure about this Italian decision. Garrett Marquis, who is a special assistant to U.S. President Donald Trump, took to Twitter to lambast Italy for the move, saying the Italian government had lent, quote, legitimacy to China's vanity project, end quote. But if we look a little below the surface here, it looks like Italy and the 13 other less powerful European nations who have signed up for the BRI so far may not be doing it in spite of U.S. opposition, but actually because of U.S. opposition, or at least partly because it gives them a chance to work against American interests. In Europe, deep-rooted anti-American sentiments are becoming a stronger and stronger force for dictating foreign policy, and signing on to China's BRI is one way the Europeans can actively work against American interests. In a report last month, Quartz said, quote, an endorsement for BRI can signal the likelihood of a country breaking ranks with traditional allies to side with China over politically charged themes, end quote. So many view this Italian decision as a signal that Italy is breaking ranks with the U.S., which, you know, America has been an Italian ally since the founding of NATO almost 70 years ago. But now Italy is breaking ranks, as the Quartz report said, and working to become more deeply integrated with China instead. And this is really only the latest indication of the fact that Europe is breaking from the U.S. and working with China and other nations to form a massive anti-American trade bloc. Xi Jinping actually spoke to Europeans recently about how mistrustful they should be of the United States. This was when he was visiting Paris in March, and he said, quote, "We should not always be looking behind our backs. As we walk forward, we should not be standing sideways to guard against each other and wary that our partners will do something behind our backs." End quote. So he didn't mention the U.S. by name there, but he's clearly referring to it and telling the Europeans to join his project instead. And all of this is moving towards something momentous, and that is the development of a massive anti-American trade bloc. And the main reason this bloc is so significant is because prophecies that God inspired to be written in the Bible thousands of years ago said that just such a bloc would emerge in the end time. Some 2,700 years ago, God inspired the prophet Isaiah to write about a huge trade bloc that would be formed in our lifetimes. In Isaiah 23:3, he called it a mart of nations. And in verse 1 of Isaiah 23, it says that one of the leading countries in this international trade bloc will be Chittim. Chittim, or Kittim, is an ancient name that's often used for the Han people that make up the majority of the population of modern China. Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry explains this in his booklet, Isaiah's End Time Vision, which you can order a free copy of if you visit thetrumpet.com. And then Isaiah 23 verse 1 names Tyre as the other main power in this mart of nations. And Mr. Flurry explains that this city represents the commercial center of Europe. One quote from Isaiah's End Time Vision says, "The spiritual center of the modern European Holy Roman Empire is called Babylon in your Bible, which you can see in Revelation 17 and 18. But here in Isaiah, the Bible refers to Tyre as the commercial center of this European power. By understanding the spiritual and the commercial powers, you can understand what a colossus is rising in Europe." End quote. There's also a companion passage in Ezekiel 27, which mentions ancient names for modern Japan, Russia, and some other nations, and shows that they too will be part of this enormous, end-time, anti-American trade bloc. To see China and Europe linked together in these prophecies, and then to see the Belt and Road Initiative and other developments linking them and these other nations so closely together today is really astonishing. In today's newspaper headlines, we are seeing the groundwork being laid for this mart of nations, prophesied of thousands of years ago, to become a reality. And what's even more astonishing is what the Bible shows that this mart of nations will do in the years ahead. Another quote from Mr. Flurry's booklet, Isaiah's End Time Vision, says, "The Bible contains many prophecies of that European power attacking America, and many other prophecies of America being besieged." End quote. And then he explains that this besiegement will be accomplished by the Mart of Nations. And he writes, quote, "All of them are going to besiege America, Britain, and the Jewish nation. China and the giants of Asia will form a brief alliance with the European bloc. Should Europe, the resurrected Holy Roman Empire, find a way to take advantage, even for a moment, of key resources and strategic holdings of China, Japan, and Russia, it would have more than enough power to besiege the Anglo-Saxon nations." And then Mr. Flurry writes, "This is why Isaiah's prophecy of an end-time mart of nations that includes both European and Asian powers is so intriguing, and why the trend of collusion between these two great economic blocs is worth watching." End quote. Mr. Flurry also draws attention to Latin America and the deeper influence that the Europeans, Chinese, and others are gaining there, because that's really the U.S.'s backyard. And with this growing control in Latin America, the European and Asian powers will be in a position to lay siege to the U.S. They'll be positioned to block it out of world trade. One more quote from Isaiah's End Time Vision says, "With a German-led Europe possessing great maritime power, North America will be surrounded on the east by Europe and the south by Latin America." There's another prophecy recorded in Deuteronomy 28:52 that gives even more details about the besiegement of the United States and the United Kingdom by the Mart of Nations. It says, mostly addressing the people who became the modern U.S. and U.K., quote, "He shall besiege you in all your gates until your high and fenced walls come down." This is a passage that we go to often because it's packed with meaning for the modern time, and it helps us to see that the anti-American trade bloc that is rapidly forming today is leading to an overthrow of the existing global order. So China's growing dominance of world trade and its strengthening links to Europe with the BRI, especially now that Italy is on board, is revealed in these Bible prophecies. These developments point to a very bleak future for America and some of its allies. They point to a time of unprecedented destruction for them. But the trends we now see playing out with the BRI and related developments are really confirming the prophecies of the Bible. And what else does Bible prophecy say about what will happen beyond the time of this economic siege and fall of the United States and Britain? Well, it prophesies of the most hope-filled era in human history. Mr. Fleury writes about this also in Isaiah's End Time Vision, saying, quote, "That trading partnership between the Asians and Europeans won't last long. Soon they will clash just before Jesus Christ returns and destroys both of them." End quote. So it's clear that Christ is going to return to earth and put an end to this trade bloc and to mankind's self-destruction. And he will usher in an age of cooperation and peace and abundance for the whole world. One very powerful sentence from Mr. Fleury's booklet says, quote, "Thank God there is great news beyond the bad news."
Thank you, Jeremiah. You mentioned early on in your report about Italy joining the Belt and Road Initiative, this being one of several instances of this developing cooperation between China and other countries. Can you give some other examples?
Yes. Yeah, that's really just kind of the tip of the iceberg of this just gargantuan anti-American trade bloc that's being formed. In recent months, we've also seen China and the European Union make a joint commitment toward the Paris Climate Agreement and also toward building a multilateral world order. We've also just seen Europe and Japan sign a historic free trade agreement that removes or reduces all tariffs on exports between the two of them. So with the stroke of the pen, that deal created the world's largest open economic area. That was a huge development. And then we've also seen Europe and China and also Russia making deeper inroads into Latin America lately. And that's almost always to the detriment of the United States relationship with Latin American nations. So some of that Latin American influence, the increase in it, is happening with Europe's efforts to make a free trade deal with the four founding members of Mercosur. That's Argentina, Brazil, Paraguay, and Uruguay. And some of it's also happening with Russia's expanding military presence, especially in Venezuela, which we've spoken about on the show recently. And then some of it is happening in connection to China's Belt and Road Initiative, which China, you know, In the context of the Belt and Road, China refers to Latin America as a natural extension of the Belt and Road. So it's hard to see how that's part of this. You know, the ancient Silk Road obviously didn't include it. But these are all just huge developments, and it's all sort of telling the same story. It motivating all of it is a desire to exclude the United States.
Well, yeah, that's the interesting thing about that, because you mentioned just the fact that this is all unfolding, the countries coming together. They're specifically listed in that Mart of Nations prophecy in Isaiah, but you also see all of these clues that it is fundamentally an anti-American effort, and so that just puts the prophecy there in Isaiah in the context of all of these other prophecies about the besiegement, about the times of the Gentiles, that just this huge change over from the era of American dominance to these other nations really taking its place.
That's exactly right. And I think it's fascinating that, Europe is historically has been mistrustful of China's rise, but suddenly their distaste for the U.S., particularly under the current administration, is strong enough to make them override all of that mistrust and to lay it aside. And instead, they're forming this alliance, basically, with China.
We've been talking with trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques about China's efforts to create a global trading bloc that excludes America. He's working on an article for the next edition of The Trumpet about this. In the meantime, you can find Gerald Flory's booklet, Isaiah's End Time Vision, on thetrumpet.com. This is the booklet that explains this Mart of Nations prophecy in Isaiah 23. And also an article called The Great Mart of Nations. We'll put a link to that in the show notes for today's program. Thanks so much, Jeremiah.
Pleasure to be here.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
The United States has the most expensive military in the world by a significant margin. Does this mean it has the most effective military? Well, a former defense official says there are reasons this may not be the case, at least for much longer, as we will now hear in this report from Andrew Miller.
Artificial intelligence and other emerging technologies are about to revolutionize the way wars are fought. According to Christian Bross, the former staff director at the Senate Armed Services Committee, a revolution in military affairs is currently underway. This revolution threatens to unseat America as the world's military superpower as U.S. rivals develop multi-million dollar technologies designed to destroy the Pentagon's multi-billion dollar military systems. Bross wrote in the May-June issue of Foreign Affairs, "The traditional model of U.S. military power is being disrupted, the way Blockbuster's business model was amid the rise of Amazon and Netflix. A military made up of a small number of large, expensive, heavily manned, and hard-to-replace systems will not survive on future battlefields, where swarms of intelligent machines will deliver violence at a greater volume and velocity than ever before." New York Times columnist Brett Stevens recounted in an editorial how the English defeated the French at the Battle of Agincourt in 1415. By deploying men with longbows against the expensive yet vulnerable French cavalry. He then cites technologies like hypersonic propulsion, space-based weapons, and quantum sensors as the longbows of today. He likens America's aircraft carriers at $13 billion apiece to the expensive French cavalry. Back in 2006, a small Chinese diesel-electric submarine surfaced within torpedo-firing range of the USS Kitty Hawk, an 80,000-ton supercarrier in the U.S. Navy. The fact that such a cheap piece of equipment was able to go undetected by either the supercarrier or its escort group should have been a startling wake-up call to the vulnerability of America's fleet. The Pentagon has spent over $18 trillion since the end of World War II. Much of it to refurbish obsolete equipment. This gives U.S. rivals an opportunity to invest in game-changing technologies. A Foreign Policy magazine report states that although the U.S. has spent far more on standing military forces than other countries for far longer, this accumulated advantage is also a vulnerability. It presents an opportunity for Washington's international adversaries and competitors to reap the advantage of their backwardness and leapfrog the U.S. with emerging technology. This is exacerbated by the Pentagon's commitment to significant investment in existing systems, the proverbial last year's model. Of course, the U.S. is also working to develop next-generation technologies. And for every analyst warning that America's enemies may win the technological revolution, there is probably another predicting that high-tech American weapons will dominate the next century. But there is a sure way to know whether or not the U.S. military will rise or fall. A Bible prophecy in Micah 5 carries special significance for the U.S. military. This passage is about the remnant of Jacob. Now, the patriarch Jacob was renamed Israel, and Micah says his descendants would receive great wealth and power from God and would dominate every other nation. But unlike most other empires, they would use their wealth and power to save and improve the lives of people around the world. Micah wrote these prophecies after the northern 10 tribes of Israel had already been conquered by Assyria, so he was not describing a period of ancient greatness under King David or King Solomon. He was describing a future time when Israel would achieve superpower status on the world scene. He was describing the generation of Israel just before the Messiah comes. He was describing America and Britain today. And at the moment end time Israel reaches the zenith of its power, God cuts off its armaments of war and throws down its strongholds. In Micah 5, verses 10 through 12, it says, "And it shall come to pass in that day, says the Lord, I will cut off the horses out of the midst of thee, and I will destroy your chariots. I will cut off the cities of the land, and I will throw down your strongholds. I will cut off witchcrafts out of thine hand, and you shall have no more soothsayers." So it's God that breaks the power of the U.S. military. Why? This chapter says it's because the people have turned away from him to embrace witchcraft and soothsayers. This means people look to false teachers who refuse to teach God's commands. Instead, they promote lawlessness and moral relativism. They endorse sins like abortion, adultery, drug abuse, homosexuality, lying, Sabbath breaking, and promiscuity. They indulge in shallow religions, false doctrines, and even literal witchcraft. Well, there are numerous ways God can fulfill this prophecy. Empowering foreign militaries is certainly amongst them. While many scoff at the idea that a foreign nation could ever defeat America's military-industrial complex, the Bible says that it is God who grants victory in battle. And without national repentance, the U.S. military will soon be facing a defeat far worse than the French suffered at Agincourt.
Thank you very much for that, Andrew. This report by this individual in foreign affairs, it makes a lot of really interesting points, one of which is essentially that the United States has been at war since 2001, almost two decades, against some fairly low-level adversaries, Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, and yet those countries with fairly meager resources have done a fairly admirable job, to put it in their terms, of keeping the United States in check, or at least preventing it from realizing its ambitions.
Right. Yeah, they bring up that that Brett Stevens report I mentioned from the New York Times makes that same point. And it's a different but related point, and that's almost more kind of getting back to like the will to use your power. Now, there is some concern that nations like Russia and China are developing new generation technologies that could actually sabotage America's state-of-the-art military systems. But when you're talking about like Iraq and Iran, I don't think there's too much concern about them having breakthrough technologies that could sabotage some of our ultra fifth generation fighter jets that we have over there. Is just more of a fact that we're sending in some of the most state of the art expensive equipment in the history of mankind and barely using it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that Brett Stevens report makes that point, especially in Iraq, that you've got fifth generation stealth fighters doing routine patrols when like a squadron of cheap turboprop planes could accomplish the same thing.
Yeah.
And so if you're barely using the power you've got, and you're holding back to such a point that, like I said, you've got like hill tribes and desert tribes with used military equipment that they've bought from like downfall of Soviet Union or something like that. But they're using it to their full potential and holding America basically to a standstill in some of these theaters.
Yeah, this idea of, I think the way that it was expressed, that we have enemies of the United States developing multi-million dollar technologies that can undermine or destroy multi-billion dollar weapon systems that the United States has put in place. The asymmetrical nature of modern warfare, where essentially you have an extremely expensive high-tech piece of equipment that could be neutralized for very little money on the other side, is a huge issue at play here.
Right, because there's always, in every war, there's a little bit of that where the saying is that generals always fight the last war, mm-hmm. or when you study warfare, you study the most recent war, but the technologies used in the last war may not be the technologies used in the next war, which is why, like I said, before World War II, France was regarded as the world's premier military force, the absolute experts at trench warfare. But they used blitzkrieg warfare techniques at the Germans and were defeated in 6 weeks. Mm-hmm. It's a new technology, a new strategy, similar to what that point made earlier about the Battle of Agincourt, where I guess France again was had one of the best, well-trained, expensively equipped cavalries in Europe, but the English had this new this kind of like emerging technology of flanks of longbow archers that were just able to decimate those forces. And so you are seeing similar things today, where you've got 13 billion dollar aircraft carriers equipped with fifth generation fighter jets, but now you're looking at cyber warfare technologies that can hack into the computer systems of those aircraft carriers. You're looking at new space-based weapons that can jamble communication systems. That diesel submarine we mentioned earlier that apparently had good enough cloaking technology that it was actually able to get within torpedo range of one of America's key aircraft carriers, that in a time of war that could have well sunk that. Probably it probably would have been a suicide mission, but it could have taken out for very little money something very big. The term you used is asymmetrical warfare is something that the Chinese talk about a lot, that they figure like we're probably not going to be able to surpass America's conventional military might anytime soon. But if you can come up with cheap ways to sabotage the technologies and strategies they're using, it may not matter because you fight battles on your terms.
Well, we've been talking with trumpet writer Andrew Miller about a report on the dangers that could undermine America's expensive high-tech military. He has an article on the subject going up on thetrumpet.com. Former defense official, military revolution to unseat U.S. superpower. Go check it out. Thanks very much, Andrew.
Thanks for having me.
It's time for today's last word.
Love can be expressed in smiles, kind words and deeds, hugs, cuddles, gifts. But did you know that at times it can also be expressed in confrontation and conflict? It can, according to wise King Solomon. Open rebuke is better than secret love, he wrote in Proverbs 27 and verse 5. Think about that. What good is love unexpressed? It benefits no one. You might feel very loving towards someone, but if you don't express it, it does that person no good. You know what's more beneficial than that? Open rebuke. At least then the person might actually profit from what is said. Sometimes rebuke can be quite helpful. Verse 6 of Proverbs 27 says, "Faithful are the wounds of a friend, profuse are the kisses of an enemy." Yes, sometimes a wound can be faithful, meaning it can support, confirm, uphold, or nourish you. Like the time your friend barked at you to quit your pity party after a setback at work and move on with your life. Are you friend enough to deliver a faithful wound when necessary? If someone you care about is doing something that's hurting them and they can't see it or they refuse to see it, someone needs to step in. The Bible is clear. A Christian cannot fear confrontation. Shying away from it simply because it's uncomfortable is a failure to love someone enough to help them stop hurting themselves or prevent them from making a mistake. If you're a parent, you must confront your children. If you fail to do so, you fail to love them. Read Proverbs 13, verse 24. Proverbs 19, verse 18, Proverbs 29, verse 15. These verses say, if you spare the rod, which is a direct form of confrontation, you hate your son. If you love him, you'll chasten him promptly. The parent who loves his child springs into action when he sees evil. Children everywhere languish under parents who fail to combat society's evil influences on our children with sufficient force, or who just ignore them altogether. You can't neglect a child. Neglect is not confrontation. Nagging is not confrontation. Negotiation isn't confrontation. Godly confrontation means you set firm rules with clear, just, effective penalties, and you follow through with them consistently. Godly confrontation is hard. But consider the alternative. As you sit back, the evil spreads. It can be like a brush fire on a windy day. If you don't stamp it out, it's going to spread. Here are three steps for exercising loving confrontation. Number one, be courageous. When the entire nation cowered in the shadow of Goliath, David ran to the battle. Most of us prefer to ignore a problem and to sweep it under the rug. But when it's there, it smolders and it spreads. In these situations, time is not on your side. Don't procrastinate when you know the responsibility is yours. Sprint forward, grab hold of the problem, and wrestle against it. Number two, be crystal clear. If you're going to really help someone, the person has to know exactly what you're asking of him. Once you've stepped forward to confront evil in the life of your child, your spouse, or your friend, make sure you state things clearly. Don't begin to back down now that you're actually eye to eye. Football coach Bill Parcells said, you have to be honest with people, brutally honest. You have to tell them the truth about the performance. You have to tell it to them face to face, and you have to tell it to them over and over again. Sometimes the truth will be painful. Sometimes saying it will lead to an uncomfortable confrontation. So be it. The only way to change people is to tell them in the clearest possible terms what they're doing wrong. And number three, be humble. This is essential to love-motivated confrontation. This should motivate you from the moment you notice something is wrong to long after the confrontation has taken place. Remember that you have sins. You need to be confronted from time to time. Don't assume you see the whole situation completely, and pray for real godly humility. In fact, the process often involves you being corrected yourself. Jesus said you have to remove the beam in your own eye before you can try to remove the fleck in your brother's eye. James 1, verses 19 to 20 say, "Let every man be swift to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath, for the wrath of man works not the righteousness of God." Proper confrontation requires emotional maturity, self-control, wisdom. If you confront with your own wrath and emotion, your impatience and frustration and bad temper, you're going to make a lot of mistakes. Don't discipline your child with those emotions, though they're only destructive emotions. Your only anger should be righteous anger against sin, directed by God and tempered with His wisdom and His mercy. Godly confrontation has to be done the right way It takes courage, it takes clarity and humility. It requires you to get rid of your pride and frustration and wrong emotion. It requires you to take personal correction yourself. But as hard as the work of godly confrontation is, don't let that dissuade you from doing it when you need to. Don't fear confrontation. Fear the sin, the evil, the suffering that results from neglecting confrontation. Faithful are the wounds of a friend. They are a form of love and a Christian duty. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send any thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to Jesse Hester for engineering and production. Thanks to my guests, Richard Palmer, Jeremiah Jacques, and Andrew Miller. I'll leave you with this thought from Otto von Bismarck. The Americans are truly a lucky people. They're bordered to the north and south by weak neighbors, and to the east and west by fish. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.